Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Have you ever worked for a cause? I don't mean just pulling down a paycheck for an organization devoted to a cause, but really working above and beyond the call of duty for something that mattered greatly to you. For Jody Williams, the cause was putting an end to anti-personnel landmines that have killed and maimed countless people, often for years after the end of the war that brought about their use. Since 1997, an international treaty has been in place which has reduced the use of and the damage caused by landmines, and the woman who helped lead the campaign to establish that treaty is my guest today on Focus. She's Jody Williams, whose work with the International Campaign to Ban Landmines led to a Nobel Peace Prize being awarded to both that organization and herself. Besides her work for the treaty, Williams has co-authored two books on the landmine issue. But her newest book is all hers in two ways. She wrote it alone, and it's about her life. My name is Jody Williams. A Vermont Girl's Winding Road to the Nobel Peace Prize is published by the University of California Press. And Jody Williams, welcome to Focus.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today. And your book's title describes your life as a winding road.
Uh-huh.
And indeed, you're right about doing a lot of things before you became interested in the landmine issue. I was wondering, when you were growing up, did you have any grand ambitions of doing something towards making that sort of difference in the world?
I don't think so. You know, when I was a kid, I was actually afraid of authority. I would get to grade school before they even unlocked the door because I was afraid I'd get a tardy mark on my report card. So I was, you know, a quiet, studious kid, helped around the house. I was the good kid. I don't think that I imagined what I'd be when I grew up, like most kids.
Something changed along the way because although it was some years before you went into the landmine issue, you were certainly involved in social action issues pretty young, weren't you?
Well, I mean, The primary influence was trying to defend my brother Steve when I was a kid. He was born deaf, unfortunately, in 1947, which is a long time ago. And it was also the period when the theory of educating the deaf was forcing them into the hearing world, meaning there was no sign language. It was very difficult to communicate. And partly because of that, but just because kids are mean to each other, the neighborhood bullies who happened to live next door were mean to my brother, and I tried to defend him. And I think that translated into trying to defend or speak up for people who couldn't or wouldn't. And then my first, you know, public protest, my first public attempt to speak up for those who couldn't was protesting the war in Vietnam in 1970 when I was at the University of Vermont. And after that, I embarked on trying to find a way to stop U.S. military intervention in countries that were trying to figure out their own political system and their own future. And ultimately, it led to landmines.
I'm interested that you made the connection, and I thought you would since you put it in the book, of that incident with your brother Steve. And mm-hmm. I thought there was one other in the book where mm-hmm. you instinctively come to the defense of someone who's under attack, just almost without thinking. It's just the decision that seems right at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is really those events had something to do with it, the activism that you got involved in really very deliberately and for the long haul later in life.
I think so. You know, I think as a kid, when I was aware of bullying, in those days we didn't have the term and the big efforts to stop bullying in schools like today. But when I saw, in this case that you're talking about, a kid in fourth grade named David, and David was the smartest, the strongest, the best at recess and all that, and he was picking on a kid named Michael who wasn't. Michael was kind of the quintessential geek. He couldn't do anything, you know, in athletics, and so he was never picked to play on teams, and there was one particular day that David was especially mean to him, and even though I was quaking on the inside and probably quaking on the outside, it turned my stomach, and it made me upset that we were kind of standing there watching it and doing nothing. So somehow I managed to make myself step up to David and call him on his bad behavior, and he let Michael play. And I was still a wreck, you know, after confronting David. But every time after that, when I would do something to speak out in situations that I thought were wrong, it became easier. And then it ultimately led, in one way or another, to being a pretty much a lifelong activist.
Now, that's interesting that you say that this was something very difficult for you to do, but you also say that it became easier as time went by. I tell you that in the book, perhaps the most surprising thing I read about you there is you're describing yourself as an introvert.
I am. I think that people confuse the meaning of introversion with thinking it means you can't talk in public, that you don't know how to have a public persona or a public, you know, grassroots activist persona like I do. I have learned to become fairly articulate. I have my good days and bad, like everybody. I'm a very convinced activist in the sense that I believe everybody has the right and responsibility to participate in creating the world that they want to live in. But that doesn't mean that I get my energy and strength from it. An introvert is somebody who gets their, you know, refills their well of energy, if you will, by being alone, by contemplating. I do it by playing with my dog and my two cats. But when I'm out with lots of people, it takes every ounce of my energy and I come home drained.
Very
but I still can do it.
That's, so you really have to, you've learned how to marshal your resources over the years.
But like most activists, it's still a struggle to find balance. You know, do you put too many hours a day or too many days of a week into trying to change the world, so to speak? How do you continue to find the beauty and joy in life? What do you do for yourself? And many activists have a real challenge in understanding it's okay to do things for yourself. It doesn't mean that you're not a great activist or have real commitment to a better world for everybody. It's an understanding that if you don't take care of yourself, you'll make yourself kind of worthless.
You also write pretty vividly about growing up Catholic, and yet you left the church at a pretty young age. Do you think your religious upbringing had a lasting impact anyway?
Yeah, it did. I'm still very fascinated by theology. I do a lot of reading. I'm certainly interested in the papal conclave at the moment. I wish they'd see the light and make a woman pope, but I doubt that'll happen in my lifetime for sure, even though when I was a kid I wanted to be the first woman pope.
So you did have a grand ambition.
Perhaps. I think it was more an ignorant delusion. I loved the smell of incense. I loved Latin. You know, it all was so almost mystical. And, you know, the priest outfit, if you will, and just everything about it was magical to me, and I thought it'd be awesome to grow up to be the Pope, because he was the most awesome of them all, in theory.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest is Jody Williams, recipient, along with the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, of the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize. And her new book is My Name is Jody Williams, A Vermont Girl's Winding Path to the Nobel Peace Prize, from the University of California Press. We welcome you to the conversation as well. You can bring your questions for Jody Williams, and if there's a cause you've put your heart into, let us know about that, too. To join us on the air, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. I was wondering, you write about your first activism, which was as a student, taking part in protests against the war in Vietnam. Was how deeply did you get into the movement at that time? Were you able to pay attention to what were the results or lack of results from the sort of things you were doing in college then?
Well, I, as I mentioned in the book, I think my primary education came outside of the walls of the classrooms, although I enjoyed learning. You know, I have, or had, at least when I was a youth, a good memory, and the American educational system tends to appreciate a good memory and spewing back the information that you memorized and the teacher wants to hear. But I was at college from 68 to 72, and that was, you know, the height of Vietnam protests and the fight against racism and the reemergence of the women's movement. And all of those things had, you know, in combination and individually, a huge impact on my perception of the world and my place in it. Until that point, I hadn't really thought about the role of a citizen, about the right to stand up and protest for what you believe is right. And protesting against the war in Vietnam really made my perception of what a good global citizen and national citizen of my own country was. But it also reshaped my understanding of American history and the mythologies that we think our country stands for. And that was really tough.
That was, so you came out of that with a different view of U.S. history and of the mm-hmm. U.S. government than when you came in.
And this is true. I believe every country creates a mythology about itself, and I call it a mythology because, you know, the great myths of history are wondrous. So when a country is focusing on its history, of course it's going to focus all the marvelous things it's done. It's not going to point out the weaknesses in its own, you know, philosophies, its foreign policy. So I grew up believing everything the U.S. said about itself, you know, the open doors and any immigrant could come here and find a better life, that we supported democracy and freedom of, you know, self-determination, that a country could decide what its government would be. And Vietnam certainly demonstrated that that was not the case. And it was very shattering to my perception, not just of the U.S., but of the world. I mean, what do those mythologies really mean then? So it started me on the road to rethinking American history, still loving my country deeply, but believing that I had to, the kind of patriotism I believe in is working to get the country to do all of the things that to really do all the things it says it does. And that really isn't the case so far.
Now, was there a period where you were not so involved in specific activism during the rest of the 70s?
Yeah, after I got out of college, I was, like too many young people, a confused college graduate. I had changed my major 5 times because I wanted to be everything and nothing. I wanted to learn everything, but I didn't know what I was going to do with it. So I graduated with a degree in psychology, which doesn't prepare you for much. So I ended up as a surgical assistant to an oral surgeon, and I certainly didn't need to go to university to do that. And then from there, I tried different things. I got married. I don't mean to say it that way. Let me take that back. I married my high school sweetheart, but by then we no longer really knew each other, and it was kind of a move of desperation for me in some ways. I didn't know what to do with myself after college, so I got married. And it was not the wisest way to go into a marriage, and we did not stay married long. And after that, I went to Mexico, trying to figure out what was my place in the world. Was it in Vermont? When I was 25 years old, it was the first time I left the state. I had thought I would be there forever and ever and ever. And then I thought that I had to go out and see how the rest of the world perceived the U.S. in part. And after being in Mexico for a couple of years, I decided that my place was back home in my own country, working from inside, trying to make it be the best it could be. So I returned to the U.S. and still continued my winding and confused route to trying to understand how to be an activist. And I finally succeeded, but it took a decade.
Well, in the 1980s, it seems like you became an activist in earnest, with organizations that were opposed to the Reagan administration's Latin American policy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, something that strikes me thinking back on that time, Yes, I can remember a time when I think some people thought that the U.S. would be sending troops into Latin America sooner or later.
Mm-hmm.
And now when people talk about, say, the legacy of the Reagan administration and whether their supporters are critics of Ronald Reagan, I don't think it's the Latin American policy that comes up first. I think it's usually the Cold War and relations with the Soviet Union and economic policies. But Latin America seems to be pushed behind a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think if we look at the history of U.S. involvement in Latin America, it takes a back burner unless and until there's some crisis or a crisis in the perception of the U.S. toward its relationship with Latin America. And as we remember, for Ronald Reagan, when he came to power, you know, his objective was to take down the Soviet Union, and to do that, he wanted to confront the Soviet Union and its client states, in his view, everywhere and anywhere in the world. And for him and Al Haig, who was his Secretary of State, one of those places was Central America. They were very upset by the Sandinista Revolution, and they believed that if they didn't draw the line against communism in Central America, that it would be, you know, on our border at Texas, and soon they'd be taking over the U.S., which was patently absurd, but that was what we were told in the U.S., and I found it stunning that people in the U.S. would believe it, and I actually started as a volunteer. I was a teacher at the time, and I got a leaflet telling me about a meeting that would talk about U.S. policy towards Salvador and how our U.S. dollars were being spent. And I went to the meeting, and I was so agitated by what I learned that I decided I would be a volunteer and hand out those leaflets. And that's how I started as an activist.
So, you know, when you I can imagine that when you first went through the meeting, you really saw yourself as just going to a meeting out of curiosity.
Uh-huh.
And that it wouldn't be, that you would not be spending the next decade working for various organizations that sent you down to Central America.
No, I didn't. You are totally correct. When I saw the leaflet that, you know, I was handed in the subway, and it said El Salvador, another Vietnam, what really piqued my curiosity was that they had put Vietnam there. If it had just said come to a meeting in the church basement about El Salvador, I would not have gone. And, it, you know, it's one of those curious twists of fate that led me to go to that meeting. And then decades later, here I am still being an activist. I consider myself to be a grassroots activist, with or without the Nobel Peace Prize. And I believe that my role is to try to help people understand that anybody can be a participant in amazing change in the world. You don't have to be Mother Teresa. You don't have to be famous and rich and all of the things we think one might have to be able to give time to making the world better. You don't. You can be a normal, flawed human being, and if you work with others toward a common goal, you can change the world. It's really amazing.
In your work in Latin America in the 80s, you worked with a lot of groups. The list I was able to collect is Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, the
yes.
Nicaragua Honduras Education Project,
yep.
Medical Aid for El Salvador,
correct.
And some of these groups had very specific aims, sometimes very mm-hmm. specific political aims. That
I consider that my work was all political.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I mean, political is a big word. I think life is political.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the work in El Salvador with medical aid, one of the projects I helped create was to bring wounded children from El Salvador to the U.S. where they got donated medical treatment. That was obviously humanitarian because we were helping the kids, but it was also a way to help people in the communities where those kids were understand what was happening in Salvador and why the kids had to be in the U.S. getting free treatment. And it was because our tax dollars were providing the bullets that were causing them to be wounded and need surgery that was not available in their own country. That's political, even if at the same time it's humanitarian.
Mm-hmm. Were you What I was thinking is at least some of the groups were aligned with maybe very specific factions. Were you always able to keep track of what everybody's aims were?
When I first started, I was totally clueless about that. You know, when I went to that meeting in the church basement, to me it was just a meeting to learn about what was happening in El Salvador. It took me quite a few years to understand that some of the organizations had linkages that I had not understood before. Many didn't. However, I'm glad for everything I did.
What progress were you able to see? What eventually happened in Latin America?
I wish I could say that U.S. intervention stopped because of the incredible commitment of people in the U.S. and in Central America to stop it, but that's not what happened. Unfortunately, the U.S. intervention stopped because of the Soviet Union, not because of an understanding of the right of people to have self-determination. When the wall came down in Berlin, the U.S. was really no longer interested in fighting the Soviet Union, which was no longer in existence, right? So they didn't have to fight in the proxy wars. And again, Central America became unimportant to U.S. policy. U.S. policy then was really focused on how it was going to react to a unipolar world. You know, how was the U.S. going to react in a world with no Soviet Union, where it was the sole remaining superpower, and they no longer were really interested in worrying about little bitty wars here and there. So they helped press for peace agreements and moved on. The unfortunate thing about that is that, of course, U.S. policy didn't change in the world, and it did not bring resolution to this social and economic strains that it caused those wars in the first place.
So 30 years later, when you look at that region, what's going on now?
Well, it's a region in incredible stress. In fact, a year ago, I led a delegation of women to Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala as part of the Nobel Women's Initiative, which I chair. And the purpose of the trip was to meet with women's organizations, human rights defenders throughout the region to look at the phenomenal crisis of human rights in Central America today. Now, those countries are the countries of the world where most women are killed just for the reason that they're women. It's got a term now. It's called femicide. It's horrible in Mexico, it's horrible in Honduras, it's horrible in El Salvador. So in my view, the root causes of the crisis back in the 80s has not disappeared, and it's reemerging with even more elements, of course, of the drug wars and the gangs and the drug cartels. I mean, it's really, to me, a big tragedy.
You mentioned the phrase femicide, and I can't help but think of what must have been perhaps the most difficult section of your book to write, about your meeting first socially, but then being sexually assaulted by a member or former member of an El Salvadoran death squad in El Salvador.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't as hard to write as it might have been, because I had previously done a monologue for a V-Day event with E. Wensler. What was difficult, I think, for me in writing it was that my mom would read it. You know, and I, of course, had not talked to my parents about that. They were always afraid when I went to Salvador that, quote unquote, something was going to happen to me, and I just didn't want them to worry. So a lot of times I pretended I was going somewhere else. For example, when I was going to Salvador, I would say I was just going to LA and I wasn't going to be going to Salvador on that particular trip, because the office was in L.A., but I didn't tell him about it. And then recently, I finally convinced Mom it was time for her to read my book. She was being my mother, she was worried about what I would have written about our family. She was worried about what she might find out. And she read it, and all of a sudden one night, I don't know, it's quite late for me. I go to bed early. And there was a phone call, and it was my mom crying because she had read that particular chapter, and that was tough. That was really tough.
That attack, certainly, it's a horrible crime, whoever does it. But did you think that this person, was it more than just about this person? Was it something that showed the character of some of the character moving through the right-wing political forces in El Salvador?
What I really thought about was, as I wrote in the book, I was really upset with myself for even talking to the person, because I knew that he was not the kind of person that normally we interacted with in Central America. It was clear that he was of the middle or upper class, and I started talking to him at the swimming pool because I was bored. And then I honestly feared that my colleagues would think that I had used tremendously bad political judgment and I would be judged for that. I didn't worry about stigma because he had sexually assaulted me. I think that we need to shift the stigma, in fact, from women who have been assaulted to the men who do the assaulting. In fact, that's one of the big themes that we have in our newly launched international campaign to stop rape and gender violence in conflict, which is part of the Nobel Women's Initiative, or spearheaded by. And one of the things that we believe we need to do is, you know, stop looking at the woman who was raped. Look at the man who did the raping, and why? I mean, we need to deal with helping men understand that it isn't okay, it's a crime. We have to stop impunity, and we just have to shift the focus completely and allow women to, you know, recognize they didn't do anything wrong. They're a victim. But that's what I think about mostly, honestly, when I think about it. I knew it was an attempt to make me afraid and leave the country, and I just wouldn't allow that to happen.
Well, it's time for a short break, and we'll be back with activist and Nobel laureate Jody Williams. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus with longtime activist Jody Williams, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate for her work towards a treaty banning anti-personnel landmines, and author of the new book, My Name is Jody Williams, A Vermont Girl's Winding Path to the Nobel Peace Prize. And we welcome you to the conversation this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Phone number again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Jody, I was wondering, how did you go from Central America to landmines?
I admit, I was actually asked. Colleagues of mine from Central America work. It was actually a man named Tomas Gebauer, who was directing Medico International from Germany. And that organization helped provide humanitarian relief, and they supported our work in medical aid. Tomas was in Salvador on his way back to Germany, and he called me and asked me if I'd pick him up at the airport and give him a ride to meet Bobby Mueller. And Mueller was the head of Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation. And I thought it was a little odd, because we don't talk on, you know, we didn't talk on the phone, Gebauer and myself. We only saw each other occasionally when we happened to both be in Salvador doing the work. But, you know, poor activists help poor activists. So I picked him up and took him to Mueller's office. And the long and short of it is they had tricked me there. And they started talking about this new project they were working on together in Cambodia, where they were training amputees to make new prosthetic limbs, to both, you know, give them work, but also to help other landmine amputees in Cambodia, and the number was extremely high. So they're talking about it, and they were all excited about the new clinic and what they were able to do, and I kept thinking, why am I sitting here? You know, why are they making me listen to them? Because I'd not done prosthetics work, and it wasn't really my area of interest. And then suddenly it was Bobby who said, Jody, I want you to understand the only way we can deal with this is to ban the weapon. I thought, mm-hmm. And then he said, and we think you're the person to do it. And that's how I got involved.
At that point, there wasn't really a campaign.
No, there was nothing. At that point, there were a handful of organizations that were beginning to think about it. But independently, there was no organized effort. And it was Bobby and Tomas. And then my finally deciding I was sick of Central America, to be honest, after 11 years, and that I needed new challenges to keep myself interested. And I agreed to do it. And then suddenly, you know, there's this the seed that became the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. And I could call it international because we had one German organization and one American organization. And that was how it began.
But this is really something that you got deeply involved with. It's something that really captured your heart, it sounds like.
It is. And I want to thank you. And I've thought about it every time you've mentioned this during the show. I want to thank you for recognizing that the Peace Prize was divided between the campaign and myself. Too often I'm introduced as an example of an individual who changed the world, and that's just not true. You know, no individual changes the world. I know that I brought certain skills to the effort, but so did the tens of thousands of other people around the world who worked together to make it happen. If it had only stayed, you know, Mueller and Gebauer and myself, nothing would have happened. The campaign succeeded because we were a campaign, because we were individuals and non-governmental organizations from 90 countries around the world that came together to make this change. And you have recognized that repeatedly when you have introduced me, and I really appreciate that on behalf of everybody who works in that campaign. So thanks a lot.
Well, you're quite welcome. I'm glad to do so. Some movements go on, they can go on for decades with no discernible progress, or if something happens, it's because of other factors in the mix. But the treaty to ban landmines became a reality, and I guess in about 6 or 7 years after you and your group got started. Why do you think it came about so quickly, relatively speaking?
I think there were a number of factors, not the least of which was the end of the Cold War. I think that people at that point were excited, believing the world was going to be different, thinking about, you know, a peace dividend. And so there was some sort of, sort of something in the air, in a manner of speech, about finding some ways to demonstrate that that actually might be possible. And then the landmine issue came out of nowhere, in a sense. The reality is that once the Cold War ended, people were able to get into countries that had been at, you know, a horrible war where they had never been able to go before, like Angola, like Cambodia. And what they found were millions of landmines. And so there was just, you know, all of a sudden the world became aware of what had been happening globally, you know, under the guise of fighting communism or fighting capitalism. And there was just an amazing amount of energy behind the movement and people wanting to do something. That was a big element. But another one was that we came together with a common goal. You know, it was, how many NGOs? We ended up being over 1,000 non-governmental organizations in the campaign, and each one of them was independent. Each was working on other issues, but we were able to unite around banning landmines and work together strategically, and that made all the difference in the world.
And on the other side, I guess, were governments around the world which had used landmines, stockpiled landmines, sometimes manufactured landmines, that even if there wasn't a war going on right now, they could certainly see their the tactical reasons for using them, and sometimes economic benefits for making them. But, and these are who you had to convince.
And we were able to convince some, and that also was key in making the difference. The first country in the world to stop exporting landmines was the United States. The first country to completely unilaterally ban them was Belgium in 1995. And it was individual steps like that from a variety of countries around the world that gave us the building blocks on which we could create the treaty. And it was because we started to partner with governments. We found, you know, human beings, government bureaucrats, who shared exactly the same goal that we did. And by working together and with the International Committee of the Red Cross, with some of the agencies, the UN, we were really able to transform thinking on this weapon.
I noticed, I want to bring up one name because I recognized it among the people that were working for this cause. It was a former Illinois Congressman, Lane Evans.
Yes.
Who came out of the Quad Cities and served for several years until illness forced him to retire from politics.
Yep. He was a formidable partner with Patrick Leahy, the senator from Vermont, and the two of them really, really gave us a gift in passing the first legislation to stop the export of landmines. It made people and militaries in the world believe something could happen because the sole remaining superpower was actually doing something about landmines. It was amazing.
Now, it's interesting that you bring that up because the U.S. is not part of this treaty.
Correct.
In fact, there are a lot of countries that signed on to the treaties, but some notable ones that did not.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S., Russia, China, Vietnam, mm-hmm. Cuba, Israel.
Mm-hmm.
None of them have signed on, but they apparently, at least some of those countries, have changed what they do concerning landmines because of the treaty.
Yeah, today there are 161 nations in the world that are part of the Mine Ban Treaty. And because the number is so huge and because the implementation of the treaty, meaning governments actually obeying it and destroying stockpiles, stopping production, has been so universal that it has put tremendous pressure on countries that have not signed to at least take steps to show they understand the humanitarian problem caused by landmines. But the U.S. is really the most fascinating in some ways because we haven't exported mines since the Leahy-Evans, you know, legislation in 92. We haven't used them since the first Gulf War in 91. We stopped producing in the mid-90s. We've destroyed millions from stockpiles. And we're the biggest donor in the world for mine clearance and victim assistance. So one would ask oneself, why have we not joined?
Why has the U.S. not joined?
Well, I think it's complicated and very simple. I think the U.S. military does not appreciate when civil society or ordinary people like you and I think that we have a right to say anything about the weapons that are created and used in our name and with our money. They like to make it seem that, you know, it's only experts who can understand the need for such weapons and that, you know, little people like you and me have no business sticking our nose into security and military matters. And I think that's bunk. But I think that's part of the reason why they haven't signed. In fact, I know it is because back in the day of Evans and Leahy, there was a general at the time who was the Secretary of the Army. His name was Gordon Sullivan. And he wrote Senator Leahy a letter then, and he said, if you persist on this path and you ban these weapons, you will put other weapon systems available to the U.S. military at risk due to humanitarian concerns. And when I heard that from, you know, Leahy's staff, I was horrified. I was really horrified that our military thinks that somehow they have the right to pursue weapon systems that cause more harm to civilians than benefit to the military. That's what that letter said. And, you know, I think that that is unconscionable. I think it's of questionable morality and ethics. And since we are the self-proclaimed, you know, police force of the world, I think that somebody has to be looking at what the military is doing. And apparently it's civil society, even if it makes them unhappy.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions for Jody Williams. founding coordinator of the International Campaign to Ban Landmines and author of the new memoir, My Name is Jody Williams. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Can you tell me, Jody, what progress has been made as far as defusing and removing landmines left over from past wars?
There's still a big challenge. I think that's the hardest part, is the demining. And even harder still in some ways is providing support for landmine survivors. When you take a mine out of the ground and get rid of it, it's gone. Your job, you know, job done. A survivor, on the other hand, generally needs new prosthetics like every 5 or 6 years because they wear down like a shoe. Many of them need psychological help. Many of them need job training. So it's easier for countries to donate money to get the mines out of the ground so there are no new victims rather than confront all of the difficulties of dealing with landmine survivors. On the other hand, there are significant programs in place around the world for mine clearance, training governments and, you know, mine clearers themselves to clean their own country, because ultimately they are the ones who are living there. Millions and millions of mines have been destroyed that will never get in the ground. I think we're up to 45 or 50 million landmines that are gone from stockpiles. So every way you look at it, it's been a tremendous success. I think another part of the landmine movement that has been really phenomenal is the inspiration that it gives to people to believe that they too can be part of change, that nobody has to give you permission, that if you believe something needs to be tackled, if you work with other people and you have a strategic plan and you carry it out, you can affect the world in a good way. And that makes me pretty proud, actually.
Well, we have a caller for you, and let's say hello to Belden in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi. I want to say I admire your work. I also worked on Central American issues, Solidarity Movement, and I'm so glad to hear you came out of that. I do have a question, though, about the motivation of the United States for not signing the treaty, and I wonder what you think about it. I was under the impression that signing the treaty would have obligated the United States to remove the mines between North and South Korea, and that there was great reluctance to do that, fearful that that might encourage North Korea to move south more easily. I wonder if you have any reflection on that.
You are not incorrect in that. When President Clinton at the time said he would not sign the treaty, the reason he gave was Korea. But it's a more complicated than that, because the landmines in use in Korea are not U.S. landmines. They're Korean, meaning that the U.S. wouldn't have had to remove anything, that the obligation would be Korean, and if they didn't sign, obviously they weren't obligated. And if we think about how the U.S. conducts war these days, I mean, look at drones, airstrikes. It's it's so much from the air that anyone who thinks if North Korea were to suddenly try a massive invasion of South Korea, the response would be anything but tremendous air power. I mean, anti-personnel landmines have nothing to do with stopping that.
Okay. So I presume then that South Korea has not signed the treaty either.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much.
You're welcome very much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Belden.
And speaking of air power, I just would like to note that some of us from the landmine campaign and some of us from the campaign that also banned cluster munitions in 2008 are launching a new campaign in April, and it's a campaign to stop killer robots.
As in drones?
Nope. As in weapon systems that will make drones look like the Model T of robotic weapons, if you will.
Are we talking about things that might still be on the drawing board?
Yes, we're talking about things on the drawing board that someday, is the militaries and the so-called defense industries have their way. There will be weapons that can make decisions about who, where, when, how to attack on their own. No human involvement at all.
This is tricky to campaign against weapons which haven't been designed or built yet.
Except they are really underway. I mean, with the so-called success of drone warfare, the Pentagon has thrown billions of dollars to research and development of even more so-called advanced robotic weapon systems. There is a vision for many in the military of having almost fully robotic weapon systems on the air, ground, and in the sea, so we won't have to worry about, to put it, I can't think of a nice way to say it, so that we will not be putting U.S. soldiers at risk and having their families have to deal with the body bags coming home. It certainly will be easier to carry out invasion and war if there are no human beings involved. I find it absolutely horrifying that our military is actually contemplating creating weapons that on their own can go and kill a person.
Now,
and that's what we're going to be campaigning to stop. And, of course, the drones are the precursors, so it's not like it's an imaginary weapon system. And the military have actually responded before we've even launched the campaign, trying to reassure us that they have no intention of ever doing it, which is not true.
Has this campaign become organized to the point of having a name, a website, that sort of organization?
Well, the name is the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, and we are launching it on the 23rd of April in London, at which point we will be launching the website and all of the other, you know, materials that go with it.
Well, the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, it's a catchy title.
Isn't it? Well, what they are known as technically, I guess, is fully autonomous weapons, meaning there's no human involvement at all. As compared to a drone where, yes, the drone itself can fly up to 7,000 miles, but there is a human being looking at a computer in the drone and makes the decision to fire the missiles that, you know, try to kill the target. So there's a human being pulling the trigger. What they are working toward are weapons with no human being involved at all. I find that just really scary.
Well, that's something that sounds like you found something to keep you busy for the next few years.
Unfortunately, I can never retire until the world is at, you know, sustainable peace, and I don't think that's going to be in my lifetime, but I'm going to do my, you know, my share to try to make it so.
We have just about a minute left. I did want to ask you, you've been doing some teaching in mm-hmm. recent years. A lot of it, I think, was at the University of Houston.
Correct.
Actually, some work also with the University of Illinois at Chicago recently.
Yep.
Tell me about what it's like talking to students today, and how do they compare with the student you remember yourself being back in the 60s and 70s?
Well, I think that there's some sort of belief that young people don't care. And that is not my experience at all. I think they profoundly and deeply care. I think it's a little harder today because there's so, you know, the inundation of so-called news, you know, 24/7 and the social websites. And it can overwhelm people of any age to such a degree that you almost end up thinking, if I can't change it all, there's nothing I can do to help. And I think it only takes a little bit of discussion with them about all you have to do is volunteer. And imagine if everybody who cared about an issue passionately volunteered a few hours a month on their own particular issue, whether it's, you know, stopping rape, whether it's killer robots, whether it's global warming, whether it's helping the elderly, whether it's ending poverty. Imagine our world. Just imagine our world if we all cared enough to give a few hours a month. That's my message.
Well, with that message, we're out of time, and I've been talking with Jody Williams. Her new book, My Name is Jody Williams, A Vermont Girl's Winding Road to the Nobel Peace Prize, It's published by the University of California Press. Like the title says, she is a Nobel laureate, co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997 with the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. And that organization's website is at icbl.org. Jody Williams, thank you very much for talking with us today on Focus.
Thanks, Jim.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go directly to will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, Venezuela and Cuba. We'll be talking with Venezuela expert Damaris Kanachi with the University of Illinois at Urbana in political science, and Cuba expert Maria de Los Angeles Torres at the University of Illinois at Chicago. This is Focus on WILL.